Welcome, warrior. You are listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Your host, Juvon Tai Dung Yi Soon Sin, Jorn Vestai Vampyr, and Jajim Tai Jajim will explore Klingon culture as it appears in Star Trek literature. Perhaps you yourself can hear the cry of your inner warrior. If so, go to www.kag.org and make your presence known. Learn how to join the Klingon Assault Group and begin your journey along the way of the warrior. Now, here are your hosts, Kapla. Welcome to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Book Review Podcast. I am Jim.
I am Jorn.
And I am Juvon.
And joining us tonight is Kavura from the Klingon Xeno Legions. Want to say hello?
Hello, everyone. This is Kavura.
How's your podcast going? I've been enjoying listening to it.
Oh, thank you. Yes, it's going along very well, and we're having a lot of fun doing it.
If you're not already, you should be listening to Star Pod Log.
Thank you. It's a lot of fun.
And the other one is Star Pod Trek. Isn't that not correct?
Yes. Star Pod Trek is our podcast by Nayar and Kavura that is all Star Trek. And then we also do one called Star Pod Log, which is a sci-fi fantasy podcast that focuses on the 70s. So give us a listen.
They are great shows. I've all caught up. I've listened to all of them, and I'm looking forward to the next one for sure.
And they even do book reviews too. So that's
we
fun.
Do. Yes,
they're actually. I was listening to your first Star Trek log today while I was out walking, and you guys were going over Final Frontier, which is that a part of this Rihaisoon series, or does she kind of go off in a different direction?
It's actually different. It's a different writer. It's Diane Carey, whereas this one is Diane Duane. So, but Final Frontier is just the first book that we decided to start with because we knew we would like it, and it's one that takes place in the Robert April era. And the next one will be one about Captain Pike.
Right on.
Just don't mix it with Game of Thrones, or you may have a head on a pike.
Uh-oh. We'll try.
So at any rate, tonight we are gathering here and we're going to talk about Honor Blade, the original series book number 96 by Diane Duane, published in October of 2000. This is the second of really a trilogy of books that makes up this epic story, Sword Hunt and Honor Blade, and finally The Empty Chair. In later omnibus editions of Rihaisoon, the Bloodwing Voyages, the two novels are combined into a single story, Sword Hunt with The Empty Chair left to be published separately. So this is a kind of part two of a book of a novel that has been broken into two parts. And as a matter of fact, when you start it, it actually starts at chapter 6.
That was an interesting place to start, too. It's really strange. You open up a book, because I just have the individual book, and you open it up, and it starts at page 6. Okay. Good thing I read it started at chapter 6. So good thing I read chapters 1 through 5 in the previous book.
Yeah, I was a little confused. I had to go online and make sure I didn't have a misprint.
And my problem was, having the omnibus, I had to go to you guys and figure out where I needed to start reading for this particular review.
John, you want to give us a brief summary of the plot?
Well, from the back of the book, at last the United Federation of Planets and the Romulan Star Empire have agreed to meet on neutral ground. Okay, here's an aside. It's interesting they're meeting on neutral ground, whereas in the book, they're not meeting on ground at all. To attempt to resolve the tangle of intrigue and conspiracy that began with the hijacking of the USS Intrepid many years ago. But the meeting may be dangerous as the war they hope to prevent. As a show of good faith, the crew of the legendary Starship Enterprise has been ordered to attend the talks. In their informal charge is Romulan Renegade Aiel, the wanted fugitive who, with Kirk, served as the catalyst for the current troubles. Kirk must represent the interests of the Federation first and foremost. But the best approach to an agreement remains muddled in the ever-shifting Romulan order. And the visiting Romulan party is as fractious and divided as their troubled world. Among the Romulan nobles in attendance are the hero and popular senator, Ari, who secretly rescued Dr. Leonard McCoy from a Romulan execution, and the very men and women who put McCoy on trial for treason and tried to carry out the sentence. As Kirk and the crew attempt to negotiate a delicate peace and the Romulans their tarnished honor, it becomes increasingly apparent that only course of action is to prepare for war.
So the description is very much action-packed. Kavura, what were your overall impressions of this book?
I enjoyed the book. The main disappointment really was just that it still wasn't a complete story. It didn't have a solid ending, but we know it's continued in the next book. But I do like the portrayal of the Romulans again, and the interaction with Kirk and the Romulan commander, A.L. They still have that excellent friendship going. And the new Romulan they introduced was Gurum, as one of the main characters in here. And I thought he was a great character as sort of someone who was more loyal to the free Romulan people. So, and that's the reason he was in danger in this book. But overall, I thought it was a great book.
Great. And what did you think, Javon?
I have to agree. I do enjoy the way this book is structured more than the previous one, that they ended it on a battle, which and the other one, they just kind of, the battle was like in the first third of the book, and then it felt like they meandered for the rest of it. But at least with this book, they ended on a battle, and that alone makes it a little bit better. I like that they kind of divide it, so you almost could get away with not reading the first half. You could almost get away with not reading the first book and read this one. But I am disappointed it's not an isolated story in any stretch.
Okay, and John, what do you think?
Well, going back to the point where we know the next book is coming, these two books came out bang, bang, within a month of each other. But then the third book is another 6 years in the making.
I don't think that was part of the original plan. I think they did want to release the third book a month later, but then whatever happened, yeah, I mean, I guess there must have been problems with the book schedule and with the writer maybe, and they just didn't get around to releasing it for another 6 years.
Which does kind of put a crimp on it. But again, the way they ended this book, you didn't know what was going to happen with the empty chair when it comes out. So you can stand these two together and leave them by themselves for a while.
It is a good thing that they came out with the omnibus that just put all three stories together, because it is better to just to read them all as one book.
But whoa. The omnibus has three books in it, but they're not this continuous story. The omnibus is My Enemy, My Ally, the first standalone novel.
Oh, okay.
Then the Romulan Way, which has the really good description of Romulan history interspersed within the story. And then the two books, Sword Hunt and Honor Blade, combined into a single novel as the third book in the omnibus.
Okay, so it does not have the empty chair then, so you still wouldn't get a complete story with it.
I think the omnibus, in fact, came out before the empty chair did.
That makes sense.
Okay, I personally enjoyed this one more than Sword Hunt, probably because Honor Blade completed it. But as Javon said, I thought it was written a little better. And even in the slower parts of the story, it moved along way better than Sword Hunt did.
I think some of my problems with the slowness of the story when you didn't have a really good pace came from the fact that I had read Sword Hunt and seen all that slow-moving stuff going on, so she had to overcome that, and it didn't quite make it for me.
I think this one still had a lot of talk, even though the action scenes were good, but it had a lot of conversations, which I actually enjoy, but I know to some people that makes it go a little slower, not having as many action scenes. But I liked all the interactions with the characters, the way they were talking, the contrast of the Romulans and the humans. All of that was good.
Now, in contrast to what you just said, what I would like to have seen was more of the negotiations at the table, the dialogue between Fox and Ambassador Robert Fox was the United Federation planets ambassador at this meeting, having him and his Romulan counterpart discussing the issues of the day, because then we could have gotten into what was going on in the Federation and the Romulan Empire and the strife between them.
That would have been interesting. And I wonder if that part got cut out because it seems like it could have been put in. I mean, the book was short anyway, so it seems like they would have had room to put that. And it would have been interesting.
Yeah, and in the previous book, it seemed like, you know, Ambassador Fox was going to take a much bigger role in the overall story than he actually did in this second part.
I think he did, Jim. It's just that we weren't allowed to see that larger role.
Fair enough.
Well, this is going to sound crazy, but I almost wish there were more books, that each of these storylines almost had their own book, because I find all the different stories interesting, but I find because there's just too many ideas in one book, and they almost could have been all their own stories. They're all interesting stories.
Okay, so let's talk about some of the things that did take place in the book. Let's discuss the peace conference.
Well, I want to say I like the gathering before the peace conference where they were just mingling and looking over the food tables. And when, you know, Kirk was just standing there and the Praetor Gurum went up and spoke to Kirk. I like that scene. It was just they made it very lighthearted. And it was funny how the Romulan could just, of course, we find out why later on, this Romulan could talk to Kirk and he just seemed so comfortable. And it's because he was more on the Free Rihansu side, but we didn't know that yet. And he was talking to Kirk and saying, like, you know, can I top off your drink? And it was just a very nice casual conversation and showing that these people can get along when they want to.
It was somewhat reminiscent of Journey to Babel and the gathering there with a little bit lighter tone to it.
No Andorians?
Nope.
No, just the Romulans and humans, and maybe the Layla Ru, if any of them were there.
I threw the Andorians in because they're the ones that screwed up the Babel Company.
Well, they helped to Kav going after Sarek didn't help matters in that one either.
Yes, we had a murder mystery there, which this one, well, kind of turned into attempted murder later.
Yeah.
But I don't think that one was a mystery.
Right.
So Kirk had some frustration with one of his commanders. What was that about?
Was that Danilov? Yeah, Commodore Danilov.
Correct.
And he did not seem to trust Kirk, or at least Kirk didn't think he did. And so there was some mistrust there. I mean, I think Kirk really trusted, you know, the Romulan AL more than Commodore Danilov, and really all of Starfleet. He was wondering how Starfleet was going to handle him being on this mission, which he did decide to do what he thought was right instead of just doing what they expected.
Now, I kind of, if I recall correctly, had kind of an impression that Commodore Danilov maybe felt that Kirk was being influenced a little too much by the Romulans.
He probably did feel that way. Because everyone could tell that Kirk and AL were at least friends. And so they were wondering, like, well, how far is he going to follow her into this?
And I think there was a thread going with Starfleet's feelings towards Kirk and his, and their trust of him. And that thread was not woven enough to let us see what's going on back on Earth.
I think it's entertaining that Starfleet was concerned that he was sleeping with her. because of his reputation as a womanizer.
You know, his reputation as a womanizer, I'll tell you what, when I watch original series, I really think that, that's become more so cliche and actually overblown, because I don't know. I just think that that becomes a comedy point way too much. And even though I can understand how Starfleet might be wary of this, and then Kirk being influenced in a negative way, Kirk is a professional enough to not let that happen.
That thought too.
One could say the same thing about Ael's niece, though, couldn't they?
That she was interested in Spock?
And that she would be too professional to give up the cloaking device.
It seemed like that, yes. And I can see similarities. I mean, the way Ael acted in this, and probably her niece might have acted the same way in a lot of instances.
Frankly, I think Ael was keeping it together better than Kirk was.
She was. We could hear a lot of her thoughts in the story, and she was always concerned with what was going on, and making sure that Kirk knew what was going on.
And that she had no interest in him.
And not only that, but Ael isn't accountable to anyone right now. She's just being hunted. Kirk is accountable to Starfleet and a few others. And so that kind of puts him under the microscope and makes Ael a little more free to behave the way she feels is appropriate.
Because Ael is not, well, she thinks she's being watched, because she thinks there's probably still a spy aboard her ship that we don't know about yet. But yeah, that she knows that the government, she's finished with the Romulan government. So she doesn't have to really act a certain way for them, because she has left them. She's doing what she wants to do now.
Yeah, and if she finds that spy, that'll be the end of that.
No, it won't.
Well, I mean, we hope it's not someone close to her like her son again.
Oh, yeah, that would be bad.
Spoilers!
Oops, well, I don't know any spoilers.
Oh, my goodness. You mean we're spoiling an 18-year-old book? For shame.
No, actually, it comes out in the next book.
So a 13-year-old book.
Ah, well, we're speculating, and if we just happen to stumble on something, that's okay, right?
I mean, I've read the book, so I'm ready for it, but I'm hearing all you guys' speculations, and frankly, you're hitting the nails on the head.
So...
Oh, that's interesting.
Could we say that this is somewhat predictable?
Well, yes and no. When you get there, you'll have that aha moment that a good mystery writer does when things are revealed.
Okay. We had a really neat character added in here. Praetor Gurheim Trisedri. Did I say that right?
That's the one that I've been calling Gurim. I just say Gurim.
Okay, Gurim. I'll go with that. That works for me. What a neat character this guy was. I really enjoyed reading about him.
He had a great interaction with Kirk when he met him, and Arai, the Romulan. He goes to see her, and he has that personal cloaking device.
Yeah, that was interesting.
And needed for the plot later on.
There is some interesting tech in this book too.
Yeah, there's some that personal cloaking device, right, is reminiscent of Dune, of the shield generators.
Odd. I thought of it as the Cone of Silence from Get Smart.
It could be both.
As long as it works, because the Cone of Silence never does.
No, it does not. But there was an assassination attempt on this praetor. He was very amicable with everyone. He seemed to be a happy person, which I guess is not a good thing. And there was an attempt on his life.
I think they knew that he was onto something, that he was doing something covertly, which he was. So someone knew about it, and they tried to take him out.
So what exactly was he up to?
He went to see Arai, and it seems like he didn't really say much to her, except that he even knew that there would be an attempt on his life when he talked to her. It was because he had been meeting with people, I'm remembering correctly.
I think there's also the point here that wasn't he one of the three triumphant praetors, and they wanted to get rid of him because he was not as militaristically for the war as the other two?
I think that is it, because he wasn't part of the three that were the current three, but he was a praetor. And so he was not as much for the war. He was more for peace. That the ones that were in power, the three most powerful praetors, felt like he was a threat to them.
He was the guy who maneuvered her to be on in the negotiation peace conference thing to begin with, wasn't he?
Yes.
Right. It's been a while between the two books, so, and they're all like made up names, so sometimes it's hard to keep them straight.
It's hard to keep the character straight, but I think you are right. Well, it was one of the three main praetors that arranged for her to be on that Romulan ship that was going to the negotiations. But I think he did it through Gurim.
And then there's the three Klingons that were introduced in the earlier book. What happened to them?
I think the author is saving them for the next book.
If you say so.
You know, when I saw their names on the list of characters, I was like, wait, did I miss a chapter or something? I don't remember thinking about
them. I crossed them out. The idea was to bring up the point of what happened to these characters. They're introduced and they just disappear.
Yeah, I think it was pretty much implied that the Klingons were just going to step back and wait to see the outcome of whatever is going on between the humans and the Romulans, and then step in and pick up the pieces from whichever side won. Or perhaps even maybe, who knows, maybe ally with the winners.
But there is talk throughout the book about the Klingons. They know that the Klingons are a threat. And I think the Romulans see the Klingons of as much of a threat as the Federation is.
And here's an interesting possibility that could have been added to this novel. What if a Klingon ship arrived and demanded some representation in these peace talks?
I think they would have to grant it then, wouldn't they? Especially with the neutral third party there.
And the Organian peace treaty.
Yes, but in some ways, didn't they mention that might have just fallen by the wayside? Like, where are the Organians now? They could have been doing something to them, and they haven't been.
No, but that's just an aside thing there, so.
Didn't we discuss previously, though, that this may be... this is kind of an alternate universe kind of a story. It doesn't really fit into canon.
At the beginning of the third book, there's an editor note saying that this is like an alternate future of TOS because her first two books clearly aren't in continuity with the rest of it, but they're interested in writing more.
Okay, so in other words, the Organians may not be in the picture at all at this point.
Well, they are because they mention them in the book. Kirk is wondering if the Organians will step in or if they're even really around anymore because they haven't seen them.
Yeah, they don't seem to be too interested. If they are around, they don't seem to be too interested in what is happening at this point.
Isn't this 10 years past the motion picture or something like that?
That I don't remember.
Yeah, I think that is a problem with a lot of these books is we don't know where they fit in relation to the canon stories that we do know about.
I think they dropped a star date in one of the books, and based off of that, I believe it's supposed to be 10 years past the motion picture, or maybe it's 10 years before the motion picture. The covers are misleading because they always draw them in TOS stuff.
Well, not only that, the impression that I'm getting from the earlier books is there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of continuity between authors and things like that, as though they were commissioned or contracted to do a story, but they did not communicate back and forth, or even maybe not even read each other's work in order to have a sense of continuity.
when we talked with Dayton a few months ago, he was saying that today there is a give and take between the authors and the editor to keep the stories in some sort of continuity. But you're right. I don't think back then, I don't think that was the case.
When the earlier books came out in the 80s, there didn't seem to be any connection between the books. And during some of the years, sometime during the 80s, that it was actually intentional that they didn't want any of the books to be connected. But, you know, I'm glad they lifted that rule later on and let them all be part of the same story, because the books are much more interesting now when they are interconnected.
I totally agree. The books for the last 10 years with the bullpen of authors that they have now have just been incredible, and characters moving back and forth and interchanges. And, you know, if a character gets killed off, they don't show up in the next book again. So there's a lot of continuity, and also it allows for a lot of character growth when the authors are able to collaborate.
For these books, I believe that Diane Duane does, I mean, out of all the books that she wrote, she did have some continuing characters. I mean, like, well, in this book, you know, Arai and A.L., she used those in all of her Ihansu series. And then I also just noticed, I picked up on Memory Alpha, that the third party race in this book, the Layla Rue, they have actually been in other books that Diane Duane wrote. So, I mean, she's keeping some of her continuity, which is great.
Okay. So we did have a space battle in this one. The Bloodwing comes too near the conference, and we get a little bit of a furball going on. You want to talk about that?
And doesn't this particular battle lead to the Bloodwing going back into Romulan space and the Romulans from the conference breaking the conference off and pursuing them?
Yep.
So wasn't this the battle that started out with them in the asteroids around the planet, or am I thinking of the wrong story?
I think that was the first book, wasn't it? Was there two battles in this story?
No, I think there's only the one battle in this story. And it sounds like you're describing the battle in the next book, Kara.
Oh, because I have started reading the next book, but we'll get to that later.
Yeah.
The interesting thing about this battle, too, is that they use an idea that was used in another book that we've reviewed on this podcast, Prey, where a ship sneaks in on the back of another ship.
So that was more technology that they introduced in this book, that has a cloaked ship that can ride on another ship that everyone can see. So no one can see this secret ship that they have.
Which at that point, I was surprised that there was only one. I just assumed that once there was one, every ship would have been two ships and the fleet would have doubled.
Maybe they didn't have the resources to do that.
Maybe. But it is like a cool ambush technique, because it worked the way it was executed in both stories. I enjoyed it. And obviously the Kirk putting together the names of all the ships being pieces of armor or something like that, only to realize it's called Saddle, and he like had his usual suspects moment where he puts it all together.
And wasn't there something where, like, Spock figured something out just because of the name of the ship?
Yeah, that's it. The ship that was carrying, it's called Saddle or something like that.
Yes, yeah. I mean, to me, it's like, just because they named it that didn't mean that it had to be that, but I guess it was a good clue.
It'd be like us calling Heidi, doing the same thing, but calling the ship that's on the Trojan Horse. Is this weird that you would call it something that
yeah.
would imply that thing?
Or they thought that the humans didn't know enough of the Romulan language to figure it out.
Yeah, it would be safe to, even if we don't, it's just silly to do it, because it's like, why would you take the chance? Why not call it all random stuff? But I guess that could be the arrogance of the Romulans showing through.
Oh yeah, thinking that they are just too clever for everyone else.
Like, they thought it's a funny inside joke, and it kind of ends up ruining their surprise attack. Not that they didn't get off enough shots anyways, I'm not sure what part of the surprise attack was really ruined, except Kirk was on it a little bit faster than they wanted them to be.
So another thing was these, they had a few scenes on the colony planets, and One thing I like was the one where they had a woman and it had her mother, the old woman, and the old woman had the ability to, like, she could hear words, like it was like a spirit was whispering to her. And it kind of made me think that she probably has some latent telepathy. It's something that is still in her that used to be in Vulcans, that used to be in the Romulans, but now they've lost it. And it was the reason, back to my enemy, my ally, the Romulans had kidnapped some of the Vulcans to telepathic abilities. But we see here that there is a Romulan that still has it to some extent.
And that's the story of their uprising. It's kind of what I was talking about, where I almost wish there was more books in the series where they take some of these storylines and flush it out more. Because I'd be really interested to know more about this in relation to the other book, and why does she have it when everybody else has lost it? Like, it would just be interesting to see that.
Yes, and all the little scenes where there was like a colony, there was one scene on a colony planet, then another scene on a colony planet, and these are almost forgotten about in the whole story.
And Jovan, keep that thought in mind when we review The Empty Chair also, because I think you'll have that same response to the ending of it.
That I wish there's more?
Yeah.
I'd say maybe there is, but it's been over 10 years at this point, so that's probably...
So there are a few concepts that we can discuss with this book. How do you bring two old-time adversaries to the negotiating table to get them to talk? How does one do this?
In this case, I think it was because of Aiel, because she was a fugitive and she had the sword. And so the Romulans wanted her and the sword. So I think that's the main reason they really wanted to negotiate with the Federation at this time. Because they knew that she was negotiating, we'll say, with the Federation. And so that's the reason the Romulans were there. The Federation is always willing to negotiate.
Yeah, I don't think the Romulans were ever serious about negotiating. From what I read, they expected the Federation to resist.
I think the Romulans also were expecting that because of the negotiation between the Romulans and the Federation, the Klingons might jump in and try to attack the Federation to stop the negotiation.
And you know the Federation is not going to just out of hand turn AL over to the Romulans. I mean, having her around and her understanding of the workings of the way the Romulan government and structure goes, they're not going to let her go, because she's going to be able to provide some really good advice.
And she was one of the demands that when the Romulans made those four demands, that was one of the things they wanted was AL. But, you know, but of course they had to know that she wouldn't turn herself in and that Kirk wouldn't give her up. But it was just one of their demands that they just had the audacity to make.
That, and they wanted the sword as their fourth demand.
Yes, exactly.
So, you know, for our listeners' benefit, what is the big deal about this sword? I mean, it would seem to be just kind of a symbol or something to rally around, but it seems to be quite important.
The sword goes back to the Romulan Way, which was book two in the Rahansu series, and that when they explained all the Romulan history, they said the sword was one of the things. It was originally made on Vulcan by Saharian, who was a great forge master, a sword maker, and it was one of five swords that he made, and the other swords were broken or lost. This one main sword that they have is the last one that's left. And in the book, and also in the Romulan Way, at the end of the book, Aiel stole that sword. It had always been in a chamber, lying across a chair, and that's where it had always been for centuries, and she took it.
Okay, so if Aiel has this sword, and the Romulans want to go after her, and if they destroy her ship, if she doesn't allow herself to be captured, and she either self-destructs her ship or destroys it, the sword is going to be lost.
Well, at a certain point, they do say that the sword isn't important to them anymore because it's becoming a symbol for her. So they don't want to lose it. Like, they much rather see it destroyed than become a symbol of the revolution.
Yeah, I see. I thought I picked up on that at some point, that it the sword is beginning to fade in its importance in favor of bringing this renegade back to stand trial and face justice.
I think the three praetors did say that they, you know, like that they would be willing to let the sword go if they can get AL. And also, if the sword is destroyed, they can just blame Starfleet for it. They can just blame the Federation and AL for losing the sword.
So I think at this point in the story, what we're seeing is the sword is a metaphor for the honor of the Klingon, or excuse me, of the Romulan Senate. And as they lose their desire to possess the physical sword, aka their honor, they would rather see it destroyed than slip into the hands of the Federation.
Yeah, to this generation of Romulans, it's lost the meaning that it had to be to the people who came to the colonies to begin with, which was it was a symbol of their connection to Vulcan and the war that they went through. And it also is like a representation of the leader that they lost and how he's always with them. And he put that sword there to represent the mentor that who was lost too. So it's just kind of a reminder of where they came from.
Well, like I was saying, the way the Senate and the way the leaders of the Romulan Empire think about the sword, it's reflected on how they're thinking about their own personal honor.
About how the three, what we would call evil praetors, they just cared less and
they cared less and less about it.
Yes. Yes. And AL, she cared more about it. And also in this book, she put the sword in her command chair on the Blood Wing. And that was a neat move too. It's like this is what we're fighting for. This is what's important to us. It's even more important than my command. That's why she put it in her chair.
Yeah, but if she's going to put it in her chair on a starship that's going to be banging around the galaxy, she better have enough duct tape to hold it.
Yeah, that is strange, too, that it, I mean, like, how did she expect it to stay there? She didn't say that she strapped it in or anything. Plus, she didn't have a place to sit. She, you know, she sat at the helm or something like that whenever she was on the bridge.
Well, she did comment about that fact. And so, to her, that was a sacrifice.
I think you guys are getting into the next book, because where I ended, she just put the sword on the chair and she stood behind it.
Oh, okay.
Okay. That's the problem with reading the entire set. You don't know where things stop and start.
Okay, everybody, just ignore what went before there. We'll continue on. Now, we have already...
Please look into this light, okay?
Yeah, there you go. There's four lights. There are four lights. Okay, so we already know from the last book we read that the Romulans suspect Kirk and A.L. of having an affair. Now we have Starfleet suspecting Kirk and A.L. of having an affair. We know that they are not involved that way. So how trustworthy is James Kirk, and how is he being viewed in the eyes of Starfleet, in the eyes of the Romulans, and from the point of view of members of his crew?
I think in this book we see more about how he's being viewed by his crew and how he's being viewed by the Romulans, then how he's being viewed by the Federation. They really needed to go into more of that.
And it seems like he's getting more respect from the Romulans and from his crew than he is from Starfleet. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that the Romulans and his crew, I mean, they get to see him every day. These people at Starfleet Command, they don't really know what he's doing out there all the time. And they don't realize how hard he's working on this, how many sleepless nights he's spent over all of this that's going on with them.
Hey, when you get the job done, nobody thinks about you.
Yeah, and we can safely assume here, I think, that Kirk wants to avoid a war, okay? And he's not getting the support of who should be behind him as much as he should be. you know, the Romulans are supporting him more than that, which I guess maybe calls his honor into question.
Well, they also think that he has been successful on so many missions that he'll be successful on this one just because he's Kirk. But then they also see him as a little flighty and a little not always obeying orders either.
And they also intentionally cut him orders and write policy for him that it's vague enough that if it goes wrong, then they could just blame him for not following it properly because they made it so vague and open interpretation. So they're almost just looking for a fall guy later when everything goes wrong.
And I believe it comes out that he's got sealed orders from the president of the Federation that nobody really knows what those orders are. And it's a dilemma as to what he needs to carry out.
He's always worried about the sealed orders, even though like we don't know it is, but yeah, that's something that it's always a concern to him in this book.
And we never do find out what those orders are.
We will.
You heard it, folks. John said we are going to find this out. So that's all right.
All right. Did anybody have a problem with the surgery at the end of the book and how detailed and graphic it became?
Yes, I thought it wasn't really necessary. Yeah, yeah. Why would they spend so much time on the surgery? I mean, describing that in a book, it did seem strange.
I didn't see the ordinary because it just kind of seems like her style of writing that she likes procedures and the nitty gritty of stuff. So I'm not surprised that she gets into a lot of detail about the surgery and what they're doing to save them. It just seemed like her style, so I just kind of went with.
And for me, I this is one of my favorite parts of the book. I kind of like the jargon that was going in there. I like the description of the surgery itself. And even though that we were getting some details that many would think are unnecessary, I'll tell you what, I was really absorbed in this part of the book.
And well, my point is mainly that wouldn't we rather have seen that kind of a detail in the negotiations earlier on and just said the surgery went like,
well, one of the things that scene gave us, what was how hard McCoy worked at saving him. I mean, this shows how, you know, the human side, like how much he really cared about saving this other alien that we consider to be the enemy.
But we already knew that about McCoy.
It was also dropping hints about he was talking about how he wasn't. He's like, were the doctors just incompetent, or are their technology really that far behind? So it kind of tells you. I think that, to me, it feels like that's a hint that not only did they try to kill him, but the surgeons were in on it, too. They're just doing a really bad job of trying to save him.
I think McCoy mentioned that he thought the other surgeons didn't really want to save him. They pretended to try to save him.
Yeah, but he noticed that early on, and that didn't come out in his actual surgery that he was doing. It came out before he ever started.
I thought it was interesting. I thought it was more interesting than the description of the Starburst, but I do like her. You know, it's something different that you never really thought about what McCoy would be doing in surgery, because usually just waving salt shakers around. So it's cool to see what he would actually be doing.
Or giving pills to somebody to regenerate a liver.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you there, Juvon. This, as I said, this was the most interesting part of the book to me. This is what really reached out and pulled me in.
So you got pulled in right at the end.
Well, I was invested in the book all the way through, but my interest, I should say, probably my interest got peaked at that point where the surgery was going on and Dr. McCoy was doing his work and, you know, making these things happen and figuring it out, even though he's not very familiar with what's going on, and how he brought Dr. Mabinga back in to help out because he understands Vulcan physiology. Of course, that would transfer over to the Romulans. And it was just, I just felt like the story was coming alive a lot at that point.
Yeah, it's funny you should say coming alive when someone's dying, but I see your point.
Going through my notes, I'm noticing that I was commenting about what did Ambassador Fox during the negotiations have to work with. And I think that works on both ways. And it's another one of the reasons it would have been nice to see the negotiations, to see the strengths and advantages that both sides could bring to each other to make a peaceful settlement.
There are a lot of things that the two cultures could share and could get from each other. And Fox was just, I mean, in this, it seems like he was just talking to Kirk. And we missed out on a lot seeing the actual negotiating and how it would have gone back and forth with him.
And what the Federation would have been willing to give to the Romulans and what the Romulans would have been willing to give to the Federation.
And I don't think either side was ready to give anything up.
Nobody talked about anything. You're right.
So another thing that happened was A.L., when she went to Spock about the, she was afraid that she might get captured by the Klingons. And so she wanted to know, like, how could Spock help her build up a mental defense against the Klingon mind sifter? And then Spock does this mind meld with her. That was an interesting scene, too. I mean, and so she was worried about that, about facing the mind sifter.
I don't think it was that she was worried about being kidnapped by the Klingons. I think it's that the Klingons had been selling technology to the Romulans, and she knew that they were in possession of a few mind sifters. She was concerned that if they recaptured, they would use it on
her. Concerned that the Romulans might use it on her.
Yeah.
Now, was there an inside scene viewing what a mind meld was like?
The author described it from her point of view. It brought up some memories of her, and she saw these scenes on Chavron. I mean, those kind of things, yes, showing what it was like for her, and it's saying that Spock was leading her into it.
Okay. That was another thing like the surgery later on that also grabbed my interest a lot. I don't know. I guess maybe it's more of the inside stuff that interested me than the overall story, because of course the negotiations
fell flat.
Yeah, they were meaningless, and there wasn't really anything we were negotiating for, with the exception of getting AL and the sword back. And we know the Federation's not going to do that. So I think maybe it's some more of those detail things that held my attention than anything else.
Well, if you look at Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, it all started from a very hard place where Praxis blows up. So you've got a point where the negotiations can start and move forward, and there's real consequences to them that I don't think you saw here.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
This book had the Romulans. I mean, like in Star Trek VI, you had the moon Praxis that just blew up. So in this case, what the Romulans have is their outer worlds are rebelling against them. So that is their tragedy that they're trying to overcome.
But they're trying to keep that more hidden than the Klingons did about Praxis.
Well, it's kind of hard to hide a moon blowing up.
But in this case, anybody can do it, it's the Klingons. Just, you know, enough cloaking devices.
Put a cloaking device around the explosion or something.
Put about a dozen or more. Hey, where'd that moon go?
Okay, let's move on to closing thoughts about this book. I'm really interested in hearing what everybody has to say. Kaveri, you want to lead us off with this?
Sure. I enjoyed the book. And I think it was a lot better than the previous book, just because it seemed to flesh out the story a little more. And again, the character of A.L. was still wonderful. Her interactions with Kirk and her command of her crew. I love the way her crew respected her so much. I mean, they had to, because she's a rebel. They're all joining her. They're all outcasts now. And it was just a great way to continue the Romulan story. I just don't like that it wasn't the whole story.
Okay, and Javon? Oh, well, before we do that, last time we got together, we deferred rating this book because it was just a half a book. So now we have read both halves of the story. And do you have a rating to go along with it, Kavura?
I hate to interrupt you here, Jim, but I think we've gotten to the second half of this particular storyline, but not the whole story. We've still got another book to go.
So we're not going to rate these again?
What do you guys think?
I give it a 4. I think with these two books were written as one book, so I feel fine giving it a rating, even though it's clearly the first half of a bigger story, because that story still doesn't come out for 6 years. And as taking the two books and pretending they're just one book because they are, I give it a 4. I like it.
I could give it a rating. I would say 4 out of 5 because it was a good book. I think this was a good story. I liked it.
And I like that the second half, they did choose a good point to cut it in half, because I feel like if somebody just picked up the second book, they probably pick up enough of it that they understand it. But if you read the first book, you'd get a deeper meaning of everything.
Okay, and Jorn, your closing thoughts and rating?
Well, a point I've got here is we get an extensive history of the Romulan Empire in the Romulan way. But does Honor Blade really add anything to our knowledge of Romulan history? And the only reason I bring this point up is the author, and I'm harping on this point, I know, the author has given herself a really good opportunity to go into this. If she had gone into the negotiations and we could have seen the two sides discussing their differences with each other, I think this is a missed opportunity. So I'm going to have to stick with a 3.5 out of 5 because it's a missed opportunity.
I liked this story, this part of the story, and it did kind of complete things, but it really, as John says, I have to agree with him, it didn't advance the Romulan story very much, and it was actually kind of, to me, an empty shell. The book was better. This book, chapter 6 through the end, was much better in my mind. I enjoyed it more. I was more engaged than I was chapters 1 through 5 in the previous book. But if I put the two together, I would have to call them both a 4.
Which is still pretty good.
Yeah, because I'll tell you what, the other book by itself, I was ready to call that a 2.5 when I had finished it.
Yeah, I have to agree. This book does really tie it together. And in hindsight, we probably should have just read the books back to back and reviewed them at the same time. But they're released separately, so they should be able to stand on their own separately under scrutiny.
Now, to our listening audience, I need to give this podcast a 5 because it did something here in the last few moments. I don't know how many people noticed it, but Jim said a pun.
Oh?
You said the book was like an empty shell. What were they negotiating in?
Okay, yeah, I gotcha.
Congratulations, Jim. You punned.
Ah, do I win a prize?
Well, there's always the Stan Lee no prize. Okay. Excelsior!
Excelsior, yes.
For the people who haven't read the other book yet, do we have any predictions?
That rules us out, Kavura.
Okay.
I think you just started.
I think I will go as far as to say that we're not going to wind up with a war. There's going to be some sort of insurrection on the Romulan homeworld. The government is going to change. AL is going to be welcomed home, and the Honor Sword is going to be restored to its position.
If this was a prime timeline story, I probably would say they're going to hand wave this all away by the end of the third book. But since this is its own reality, I think that's a pretty good prediction. I think the question is just who's going to be in power when this is all over. I'd like to say AL, but that might be a little too obvious, and I don't know if she'd even want it.
No, maybe RA is going to rise even farther.
That would be interesting, because she has risen this far to begin with. For her to go that far, that would be kind of funny, that it's ultimately the Federation running the Romulan Empire.
Yeah, well, she seems to be already on a rocket ship ride to becoming quite the powerful person.
And it makes you wonder if she's going to be discovered. Like, is anyone ever going to find out that she's actually human?
I would actually say at this point, if it doesn't become a point that she's a human, then it's kind of a waste of her even being mentioned, because what's the point of having creating this spy who's actually human for somebody not to know that she's actually human?
I sit here and say nothing.
When you say nothing, Jorn, you're actually saying a lot.
We see more from her about this. Like, I hope that it's been left open enough that she can write more books, and I hope those more books come. Like, I actually really enjoy this series. I think it's really cool.
I would tend to agree. So we should probably close this out. What are we reading next?
Well, I think we talked about going ahead and finishing this series off with The Empty Chair for next time.
So, for next month, we will be looking at The Empty Chair by Diane Duane, if you want to read along. You want to tell us, Javon, how people can find us and get in touch with us and all that good?
You can find us on Facebook or Twitter at KEG Podcast. You can email us podcast@keg.org. And if you guys have any suggestions for other books we should review in the future, let us know.
And should Kavara mention where her podcasts can be found?
I was going to bring that up. Kavara, give us a little bit of a summary on your podcasts and how we can find them.
Starpod Log and Starpod Trek. We have both of those podcasts by Nayar and Kavara. So you can find us, you can find the podcast on iTunes and Blogger and wherever you listen to podcasts. And we are on Facebook under Starpod Log and Starpod Trek. We're on Twitter under @StarpodLog. We're also on Instagram under @StarpodLog. Please look us up.
And I understand that if you have one of those old Commodore computers, we can find you on the bulletin boards, right?
That's right. We love Commodores.
Which Commodore?
The 64?
Yeah.
Or Commodore Danilov. Take your pick.
Well, I just want to make sure, you know, not the 128 then.
No, not that one.
I never got that one either. But I did like my C64.
I think my favorite part of your podcasts is the nostalgia and the memories that you bring back, because of course at the age I am, I remember a lot of the stuff that you're talking about, and it's kind of neat to hear that come back to life.
So what you're saying, Jim, is that you want to tell her thanks for the memories.
Yeah. My favorite part is how it always comes back to Buck Rogers.
Yeah.
Which Buck Rogers?
The one from the 80s, right? Buck Rogers in the 25th century? Gil Gerard? Yeah. Yes.
Youngsters. You youngsters.
Buck and a half Rogers. Hey, no, dumb. Okay, so.
Yeah, but that was the Daffy one.
Oh, but it was great fun. We're actually going to do another episode that has a whole section on that. So look out for it. Yeah.
So thank you for joining us, Kavara. We look forward to talking with you next month about Empty Chair. And I'm Jajim.
I'm Jor.
And I'm Javon. Kapla.
Kapla.
Kapla. And Kavara Jolan Troop. You have been listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group book review podcast. Bound by Honor is brought to you by the Klingon Assault Group and is produced by Admiral Kirk Zantai Loon Keej. If you hear the call of the warrior, visit our homepage at www.kag.org to learn more about what it means to be Klingon. Perhaps you have what it takes to be one of us. Listener feedback is always welcome at podcast@kag.org. Kaplop!
Romulus est, Remus est.